Well, good evening. I apologize for looming up here like this. I am. I'll be back on the floor next week. I promise. We have a new face tonight.
Hi, I'm Vicki Grumwald.
Glad to meet you. How did you find us?
The internet.
Uh-huh.
Normally we're having a Rahatsu session in Nebraska Zen Center, and I'm going to San Jose on business, and I'm like, oh, there's one 4 miles from my hotel.
Oh.
I was really excited.
So how is Nonan doing?
Nonan gave his first talk thanks to my, since surgery, thanks to my karaoke machine. He doesn't have the strength in his voice yet because his voice, vocal cords, they were like hit accidentally in the surgery. And so he gets really winded, and sometimes it sounds like this, and sometimes it comes through like this. So it kind of fades in and out, and he has to read mid-sentence, so he thought he was going to give a talk. He needs a microphone, and that's all I had. So
I see.
And so he's starting to give. He gave his first talk last week. It was really exciting to see. We all cheered and clapped when he, you know, sat in his seat. So that's really nice to see him recover, but it's been a long road for him.
It sure has. And he's been so up about it.
Yeah, he's like that.
He is like that. He's a big guy and has a big heart and a big mind. He's really an amazing fellow and a wonderful teacher. He's one of Katagiri Roshi's original students and has been teaching for a long, long time. He trained in Japan, trained very, very hard in Japan. He's one of those original Americans who went over and just did the whole thing from beginning to end. And I've met him at many teachers' meetings, so I've enjoyed knowing him. And I've had his name on my altar for months and months and months because he's been so sick. Please let him give him my very, very best. Yeah. So we are progressing slowly through Dogen's record of things heard, his short extemporaneous lectures that he gave to his young monks. And I'm not quite sure where we are, but it's around 6 or 7, I think. Is that right? Are we as far as 9? Yes, you're right. That's exactly where we are. It is 35. And we read it around the room paragraph by paragraph.
One day he said, while I was in China, once when I was in a meditation cloister reading records of sayings of the ancients, a certain monk from Sichuan, who was a man of the way, asked me, what is the use of reading the recorded sayings? I answered, so that I would know the behavior of the ancients. The monk said, what is the use of that? I said, to return to my native land to teach others. The monk said, what is the use of that? I said, it is to benefit the living. The monk said, after all, what is the use? As I later decided what the truth was here, to read the recorded sayings, the public cases, and so forth, thus knowing the acts of the ancients, or to speak of them for the edification of those who are deluded, all of this is ultimately of no use to one's own practice or the guidance of others. Devoted solely to sitting, once you have illuminated the great matter, then afterwards, even if you do not know a single letter, in elucidating and pointing it out to others, it can never be exhausted. For this reason did that monk say, ultimately, what is the use? Thinking that this is the real truth, I subsequently gave up reading the recorded sayings and the rest, totally concentrating on sitting. I was able to clarify the great matter.
So afterward, of course, he studied all of them and memorized most of them and brought it all back to Japan. But it's what we were saying last week. When you begin to practice, it's useless to read what all the great sayings are, because you don't know what it's referring to. It just becomes one more idea. I met a young woman who spends most of her time inside reading, looking at YouTube, and studying the things that are there. And she's trying to understand the world this way and is writing philosophical descriptions of how she thinks things are. She's lost in her head, and lost in a flood of ideas, but without any... she's not very settled. She's too dependent on the flightiness of ideas, trying to pin them down. So it doesn't work. A lot of times people come to Zen having read floods and floods of material and then have to shake it off for a long time. And after a while, a kind of other need comes along of an experience that is really untalkaboutable, and yet we begin to have to speak and say something. But not in a proselytizing way, because there's no way to do that and no need. It's just a full expression of our practice itself. I like the Sufi way of going quietly into after the great matter has been settled, to just go into a village and begin to sit. That's a Zen tradition too, not going and trying to wrestle up a whole bunch of students and lord it over them with great knowledge and insight and brilliance, but just to quietly go and sit somewhere and offer the space to others if they wish to come. Koban's brother often said, Hojo-sama, which he was called, which sounds like a very important title, just means a space that's open that anyone can join. I think that's a wonderful way for us all to be, just an open space that anyone can join. Shall we go on?
Page 36, number 10. In the evening, he said, without real inner virtue, one should not be esteemed by others. Since people in this country esteem others on the basis of outer appearances, without knowing anything about real inner virtue, students who lack the mind of the way are thus dragged down into evil ways and become subject to temptation. It is easy to be esteemed by others, to put on a shallow pretense of having abandoned one's status and turned away from society is merely a fabrication of outer appearance.
While simply having the appearance of an ordinary person of the world, one who goes on harmonizing the inner mind is a genuine aspirant to the way. Therefore, as an ancient said, inside empty, outside accords. What this means is to have no selfish thought in the inner mind, while the outer appearance goes along with others.
If one utterly forgets such things as my body and my mind, and enters into the way of Buddhas, acts in accord with the standards of the Buddhist way, inside and outside are both good, now and afterwards are both good.
Even in the way of the Buddhas, it is wrong to rashly abandon that which is not to be abandoned, with the intention of abandoning oneself or abandoning the world. Among those in this country who pose as Buddhists and devotees of the way too, he who acts badly for no reason in the name of abandoning the self without regard to how others may see him, or in the name of non-attachment to the world, does such things as walk in the drenching rain in spite of the fact that it is both inwardly and outwardly useless to do such things, people of the world immediately think what a venerable man he is, how detached from the world he is, and so forth. In their midst, if one observes the regulations of the Buddha, heeds the standards of discipline, and carries out his own practice and the conversion of others in accord with the Buddha's regulations, people will paradoxically say, he smells of greed for fame and profit, and will have nothing to do with him. But that, on the other hand, for oneself is following the Buddha's teachings and perfecting inner and outer virtue.
This seems like a little window into a sort of monastic situation of how it is when people come into practice as monks in the monastery and misunderstand what they're doing and begin to put on airs, I guess you could say. It's very easy to look spiritual, to enact holiness without actually finding that place in oneself. So much depends on other people's judgment of ourselves. We define ourselves by our relationship with other people, and it's very easy to fall into parading, pretending. It's wonderful that we don't have that problem. We're just walking around in blue jeans and driving our cars and going to work and coming home, and nobody has to even know who we are and what we are in the sense of all of this. It's such a relief. There's no way that we can be peacocks around our spirituality, which is so painfully useless and misleading, terribly misleading. There is a way and a place for appearing in the robe of Buddha, you could say. One of my favorite stories is of someone who was traveling in Burma with a monk, a very well-known, famous monk that everyone loved in the country. And they stood at the very back of the train on a little platform outside. And as they went through the villages, people all had gathered, and they were all bowing and praising him and weeping because he was appearing there. And finally, the Westerner who was with him said, "Boy, doesn't this get to you after a while?" And he said, "No, no, they're bowing to the robe. They're not bowing to me." So that's our, we as practicers, if robes come our way, it's a bigger responsibility in a way, that our own personal way is, well, Coven used to say the inside is expressed on the outside when we're willing to wear a robe of some kind. And then there we are, but it's not us anymore. Or it's us transformed for the sake of something larger. It's not proselytizing. Now, I don't know what he means here by conversion of others in accord with the Buddha's regulations. I've never heard any Buddha's regulations about converting others, but except in the sense that we vow to save all beings, meaning take in and accept whatever comes our way. This is very interesting. And what he's really saying is it doesn't matter what people say as far as our own practice is concerned. We just practice. We just do it. And if people think we're, what does he say? Smell of greed for fame and profit. I don't know quite how that would work either. I guess if it's hard to imagine. There must be some little story back behind all of this that we don't know. But I can't imagine any of us being greedy for fame and profit in this enterprise. And there's too much wisdom and insight going on. Are there questions about any of this? Before questions, we haven't introduced ourselves, and we need to do that.
I'm Samuel.
I'm Vicky.
I'm Dan.
I'm Dan.
Great. Wendy.
Jane.
Julian.
Comments? Samuel?
So back to the reading and the studying, is there a person or a group that just sits and doesn't study? Or, I mean, I know anything is possible, but is it possible just to sit and not really study the word or the Dharma and just kind of know that that's how it goes and keep it like really simple without philosophizing too much about it?
Well, Uchiyama Roshi created a situation like that. Kodo Sawaki became the teacher at Antaiji in Kyoto years ago, and when he was turning it over, he turned it over to Uchiyama Roshi. And he was, one, very shy. He was a man after my own heart. He was embarrassed to go up to the altar and do the rituals and the service and things. And he said, "Oh, I can't take over from you because I'm too embarrassed. And I always make mistakes," he said. "I'm always stumbling around." And Kodo Sawaki said, "That's fine. Don't worry about it. Just do it your own way." So he created a practice there that was mostly just sitting. And I don't know how much ritual he ended up doing, but of course he knew a great deal, and his heirs know a great deal, so they must have been studying at the same time. But I think that the emphasis is always on Zazen. Always. Because none of the rest of it makes a particle of sense unless you've been sitting. I always say it's like studying about swimming if you've never even seen the water. You know, it doesn't make sense. But once you've been sitting, then you want some kind of reflection and confirmation of your experience. And that's what all these words are all about, really. Confirmation of the experience and kind of guidance in how to live this way. Because it's if you sit long enough, it's mind-blowing. And it takes some courage to integrate it and stand up and live it. So then we need all the help we can get. But it's easy to get caught up. You know, there are endless old stories about the monks who memorize a whole sutra like the Diamond Sutra and think they've really got it because they know all the words. And then, you know, some old lady catches them up because they don't really understand any of it. So it's not an intellectual exercise, this practice. So we do use the intellect very carefully and respectfully.
But in a way, isn't it going back to the swimming thing? I guess it depends what our intention is. If we want to swim or learn how to swim, we could swim perhaps faster if we got a teacher to show us the stroke rather than,
yes,
you know, be doggy paddling for about 6 years before we get a stroke that,
yes,
know, can get somewhere. Or let's say we want to cross the English Channel rather than freeze, you know, study.
Well, study, I thought you meant study my reading and memorizing all the works of other teachers.
No, I didn't mean memorizing, it's understanding.
Well, sure.
So
but then you need a teacher to teach you how to swim.
But is my initial question is it really that important? I mean, in a way I feel it is important.
Yes, it is.
To deepen your practice, or like my grandmother never read, one of my grandmother, and she's just, in my book, she's a saint.
Mm-hmm.
My grandfather would sometimes read it, but she just sat there. So in a way, it feels if you know, faithfully sit, you almost don't need it. But then on the other side, the swimming thing, it's like, yeah, you can get somewhere in a much better way if you learn the good habits.
Yes. Yes. Yes,
it
exactly.
It is important at some point to start digging in and studying.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, both sides. Because as I say, when the monk shamed him or embarrassed him about why he was doing all his studying, and he dropped it and just began to sit. But after that, he did study greatly and brought all the koans back. He knew them all. He knew the Lotus Sutra inside out and used it his whole life, example after example, from his studies as teaching, methods of teaching, helping people to see clearly. So you're right, it's both. Absolutely both. And I'd love to know your grandmother.
Yeah, I couldn't read. On the other hand, my other grandmother taught herself how to read.
Amazing.
And became the first certain sect in Christianity in Syria to become the only woman there, or the only, not just woman, but the only Seventh-day Adventist. So she started reading about it, and other people wanted to know what she was doing.
And they joined her?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And it's still there?
Well, she's gone.
Yes.
But there's few people that are very small, moving it around.
Hmm.
Kind of like this.
This is the best.
That's what they say, too.
Yeah. That's how it all begins. Oh, thank you. Jillian?
Question. In terms of, like, reading the texts, it seems like the meaning of what you take from the text kind of, like, evolves
mm-hmm.
as your practice.
It does.
Evolves, like... What's up with that?
I don't know how that works, really. I think it's quite amazing. I always think that if it's Dharma, if it's truth, that it can be new every time we read it. And the sutras are certainly like that, because we change. And if we're in the way of it, if we've begun to be in the way of it, then each time we read it, we begin to be, I don't know, empowered more empowered in the way, or we recognize more. There's some kind of flow in there that just goes on for a whole lifetime, I think. At least I've been doing this for almost 40 years, and it's all still new. I'll pick up Zen Mind Beginner's Mind, and it's new. No, there's always something in there that strikes me, and I, yes. It's wonderful.
What did you mean by get in the way of it? Reading a sutra, and if you get in the way of it, what do you mean? Like your ideas get in the way of it? Or?
No, I don't mean in as blockage. I mean as that the way is a kind of movement, and if you get into the movement yourself, then you're carried by it. That the sutras carry us in a way, and each time we dip in, we're new and it's new, but we've already are on that way.
Okay, and so how would you get it? What would be an example of getting in the way?
Picking it up in the first place and recognizing it.
Oh, yeah, this again?
No, the way-seeking mind kind of thing. Of recognizing a truth and being moved by it and changed by it. At least my experience in picking up material, any of the material that comes out of our practice is like that. And some of it I don't get, and some of it just sometimes I feel like I'm in the rapids. No, I just it's fast and intense. It's so full of life and truth. So it's like that. Maybe it's not a very good metaphor. Anyway, that's how it feels for me. Dan?
Kind of reframing the particular story he said into something that's recently I've been thinking about. If we generate thoughts, busybody thoughts in our head, and we therefore are creating appearances ourselves, that, I've noticed, creates fear in me about, quote, the non-appearance, real things behind. So, going back to the example of the swimming, if you read a book or see somebody else swimming and you say, wow, I could drown, you're creating all kind of ideas about what could happen and, you know, you could drown, you could have fun, you could go from here to there, all these different possible ways it could play out. And then you realize, I'm afraid of that reality. I don't want to jump into the deep end of the pool and actually start swimming. Is how does that metaphor of that fear fit in with our practice? Is our practice to face the fear and jump into the pool anyway? Or you live with the fear until you have the courage to simply say, I'm actually not afraid, and you jump in anyway. But that's different. That's a different jumping in than the one when you were afraid. And it's like, this is happening to me a lot lately. Like, I know what the reality is, but I'm afraid to do it. So how does this manifest in terms of practice?
It takes a lot of courage to live. And often we have to be courageous, which means having heart. With our fear. You know, in the Heart Sutra, we depend on Prajna Paramita, and no fears exist. So, you know, that's the naughty place, not naughty, but the naughty place in the Heart Sutra, where there's no attainment. So, first you have to abandon your goals. And if you've abandoned your goal of attainment, then you don't have anything to fear.
Is jumping into the pool the goal? I feel it is. I feel that knowing that there is this thing out there called jumping in the pool.
Yes.
It is a goal. It doesn't sound like a big deal, but if you are fearful enough of jumping in the pool, it becomes a goal. It evolved into a big obstacle.
You can make a big deal out of it.
Yes.
Yes. And it isn't even it. I mean, whatever you project about what you think it is, isn't it? So the only way to deal with it is just to offer yourself to be surprised. And let it be what it's going to be. And try not to make up some story about what you think it is.
I know this all to be true. And of course, I've experienced it in other domains. You know, it's not like I don't understand where I'm at.
Yeah.
I think that's interesting. It's like, in the one sense, the practice has been very good at showing this to me. Like, I can see it literally moment by moment.
Yeah.
And yet I can see that I got to have... You know, not only do I have to jump in the pool, I got to get on the diving board and, you know, really give a double, triple, you know, in there and make it a real showing.
Go for it.
So it doesn't freak me, and it's not what it was, and just enjoy it and just be with whatever it is. And I know that all to be true, and yet it's tough to even jump off the side of the walk. I know it is,
which is why it helps to have friends. And to have Sangha, so that we can encourage each other, give each other heart. It's possible to do.
We have floaties.
Yeah. If you know your fear, and if you know why you're afraid, you're already there.
It's pretty funny. What's actually happening here is I've done what I'm thinking about before. The first few times I did it, I didn't know what to be afraid of. So it was easy. Now I've done it actually a few times, and I'm afraid of doing it wrong.
Uh-huh.
Rather than just not even... The idea of doing it is one thing. The idea of doing it right is hard. So, and it doesn't, to my mind, it doesn't matter that it's this one particular thing. I think it's this whole setup, it's the framework of thinking that there's
there's this goal that's been built up in the fear and the practice and how it all fits together. That's the paradigm is what is of concern to me, not this one particular case, which I'm sure I'll eventually get over. I think it's I get caught up in that bind.
Yes.
I can see that.
And the fear is about self-esteem, isn't it? About losing one's own self-esteem,
right.
And
in
self-confidence.
Case, it's reflected. Actually, other people are telling me, just jump in the water. They're telling me, don't worry if you succeed or fail. They're on my side. I'm the one who's afraid.
Yes.
It's a self, and yet I know I shouldn't get all bent about it. They know, they've been where I am. They say, no, you just got to jump in.
I know that feeling, though. I used to say it was like a little kid digging her heels in and saying, you can't make me. I'm not going to. You can't make me. And yet knowing at the same time that that's the only thing to do. So you've got your work cut out for you. We're cheering you on.
It's easy. One of these days it'll be over. I'll just go off to a very, very high cliff and dive in.
Not too high.
Yeah.
No, be careful. You can just slip right in, you know. It's not a big deal. It's just...
And I hear the water's warm.
It's lovely. It's lovely. You'd like it.
Come on in. It's great.
Well, it's 8 o'clock.